Mr. Lavrov?
If we can start with the war in Gaza, it's now into its fifth week. Thousands of people are dead, fatalities every day. How does the Russian Foreign Ministry see its role in facilitating an end to the violence?
There are several aspects to this problem, to this crisis. The immediate task is to stop hostilities, to stop any military activity, and to take measures to resolve humanitarian problems, which are all over the place. This is absolutely necessary first step. We called immediately when the Israeli reaction to the 7th of October massacre became known, we strongly condemned what Hamas did, and at the same time called for measured response in full accordance with international humanitarian law, respecting the international requirements for treatment of hospitals, women, children, other civilians. And as a first step, we suggested to the Security Council the draft resolution calling for immediate ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, for humanitarian purposes. It was not supported, first of all, by the United States. Then the developing countries, members of the Security Council, proposed a softer version of a resolution calling not for a ceasefire, but for humanitarian truce, which was also killed by the United States. They only were ready to say a humanitarian pause, without any commitment to continue these efforts. A humanitarian pause was not something which the Arab and other Muslim countries and greater membership of the United Nations were ready to adopt. So they went to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for humanitarian truce, but it is not being implemented. And the current activities in the Security Council indicate that there is still an interest in having something from the Security Council, especially after the General Assembly has spoken. But the Americans are not going, at least as things stand now, they're not going to accept, to let go anything except a humanitarian pause with no commitment to do something else after one-time action. This is the immediate task. I still believe that this is doable. We leave to the authority of the United Nations, United Nations Relief and Work Agencies in Gaza, the efforts to defend their mandates, which are also under huge threat. But when this immediate fight is over, with all the understanding that terrorism cannot be accepted in any form, and that respond to terrorism must be fully in line with international humanitarian law. At the end of the day, as Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, said soon after this started, the attack of Hamas took place not in a vacuum. So the second aspect of this problem, which is much more important, the cessation of hostilities and stopping of violence, is of huge importance to the civilians. But in historical terms, in sustainable settlement terms, the creation of Palestinian state is unavoidable. And the discussions which are taking place around the future of Gaza, most of them avoid concentration on the implementation of resolutions of the Security Council to create a Palestinian state next to Israel, living in peace and security, coexisting with Israel in peace and security. Borders were indicated as being 1967 borders, capital is Jerusalem. All this has never been cancelled by the United Nations.
Can I touch upon something you said there? The resolutions that were put forward by Russia twice as well, rejected, vetoed by the US. Do you think that was because Washington didn't agree what was in those resolutions, or was it more to do with just rejecting anything that has Russia on it?
No, I think Washington, well, maybe both. Of course, these days Washington is highly ideologized, and anything coming from Russia is taken as a hostile act, hostile initiative. But on substance and practical terms, Washington does not want to tie Israel's hands. It works with Israelis, I know this, and tries to persuade them to be a little flexible regarding the supply of humanitarian goods, medicines, other stuff necessary for hospitals functioning, and also be flexible for letting the foreigners out of Gaza. But the key reason I believe that Washington doesn't want this to stop the way which Israel doesn't like.
The possibility of the conflict widening, going beyond those regional borders, it appears to be a growing concern. Some are anticipating the United States to confront Iran, with expectations that Moscow will then lend support to Tehran. Your thoughts on such a scenario?
Well, I think people who float this kind of scenarios, they really want to provoke a bigger crisis. Maybe this is what the Americans want. My president recently addressed the issue of international situation, giving a lot of examples showing that the Americans normally, whenever they come to a region of this planet, they bring chaos, which they believe they can manage. They bring victims among civilians. I don't even want to mention Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria. None of these places where they declared they want to bring democracy. None of these places is better off than when they interfered under the false pretext, quite often, like it was in Iraq. I believe that neither Iran nor Lebanon want any involvement in this crisis. They certainly have Hezbollah in Lebanon, an organization which is devoted to defending the Palestinian cause, the cause of Arabs in the Middle East, and they exchange small fire with Israelis every now and then, but this was the case even before the 7th of October. And Resolution 7001, which determines the regime in Lebanon from the point of view of military and political approach, it has been violated both by Hezbollah and by Israelis repeatedly. But there is no appetite from Lebanon, and as far as I can judge from the recent statement of Hezbollah leader Nasrallah, there is no appetite for any big war, unless provoked, unless Gaza is no longer considered as a place where Palestinians should continue to live. And I don't see any appetite in Iran Yes, Americans say that some pro-Iranian armed groups in Syria and Iraq are trying to attack American military sites. This is reported by the media, and this is nothing new. Mm. Nothing new in this, because these groups believe that the presence of the United States in Syria is absolutely illegal, and this is statement of fact. The presence of the United States in Iraq also causes quite a number of questions, because quite some time ago the Iraqi government and the Iraqi parliament decided that they discontinue the agreement to the acquiescence with the U.S. troops present on their soil. Mm. But Americans still keep some 5,000 men there without any firm legal ground. Again, maybe the groups, the fighters in Syria, in Iraq, some members of Hezbollah, maybe being agitated by the fact that the Palestinians are treated the way they are, maybe they would be continuing to bite Americans and Israelis here and there. But I don't see any readiness, any appetite, either in Iran or in any other Arab country, for a big war in the region. The problem is that if this restraint is going to be considered as weakness and as a green light to do anything in Gaza, this would be a huge mistake.
Okay. As the conflict plays out, different states have taken varying approaches to their relations with Israel. Some have severed ties altogether, and some are fostering cooperation. Where does Moscow stand?
Well, we never, during the last 30 years, we never tried to underestimate the importance of good relations with Israel and the importance of good relations with Israeli Arab neighbors. And we played a role promoting peace on the basis of the final solution of this Middle East issue in accordance with the United Nations resolutions and decisions. We have been a member of the quartet of international mediators from the very beginning of the functioning of this structure. The only structure recognized officially by the Security Council as having the mandate to mediate. We were co-sponsors of the roadmap, which provided the specific steps to create Palestinian state viable and secure in I think, 15 months or so. Never implemented. A resolution by consensus, never implemented. Then in 2007, I think, we launched another initiative trying to update the roadmap and to give it some push, to give some push to the direct negotiations. We suggested to convene a conference on Israeli-Palestinian normalization and on the creation of the Palestinian state in Moscow. And this proposal was again unanimously endorsed by the Security Council resolution, never implemented. You know, we always understood, and President Putin, whenever he visits Israel, whenever he receives Israeli leaders in Moscow, he always emphasizes that when he first came to that place, not being president in his previous life, when he worked in St. Petersburg and they had some business contacts with Israeli colleagues, he said, when I saw Israel and its geography, I immediately understood why ironclad security was so important for Israelis. And this was his conviction from the very beginning. And he never, ever give any reason to believe that we underestimate the importance of security for the state of Israel. Not to mention that we were, the Soviet Union was instrumental in creating the state, but also in defending the state with arms and weapons and with some volunteers. When immediately after Israel was announced as a new state, it was under threat. So we always paid attention to this, but at the same time, we were taking the stance and explaining this stance to the Israeli government that you cannot buy security, which we are convinced you need, by delaying the creation of Palestinian state and by creepingly reducing the territory which was designed for the Palestinian state by the United Nations. You know, at some point, I thought we were very close, because in 2016, when the Obama administration was spending its last year, in summer 2016, I don't think I reveal a secret, Prime Minister Netanyahu called President Putin and said that he would like to start direct negotiations with President Abbas, provided there are no preconditions. And at that time, the Palestinians were very much upset with the settlement activities of Israel, which was expanding, and some Palestinian homes on the Palestinian territory were destroyed and families thrown out. So the Palestinian administration at that time demanded as a precondition that this must stop. And when Netanyahu asked Putin to convey to Abbas that he would be ready for direct negotiations, but without any preconditions, President Putin called President Abbas and delivered this message. And President Abbas said, since this is coming from you, my good friend, as a matter of exception and respect, I accept this offer. Let's find a day, and this was July, August. Let's find a day, a date in September 2016. We immediately informed the office of the Prime Minister Netanyahu, and nothing happened. My point is that there were so many opportunities missed. There were so many attempts when a deal seemed to be close, so many attempts to replay the game, it became, you know, kind of tradition, and on both sides. There were also some twists in the Palestinian position. It's unfortunate, but we keep our relations with both parties. Soon after the terrorist attack of the 7th of October, President talked to Prime Minister Netanyahu, to President Abbas, to leaders of other Arab countries, and just yesterday he talked to President Assisi of Egypt, and we continue our contacts at the level of ministers. I spoke with Foreign Minister of Qatar, Foreign Minister of the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and we'll continue to push for the immediate goal, cessation of hostilities for humanitarian purposes. After that, we all must take deep breath and think how we restore Gaza, how we make sure that no one is expelled from Gaza, that there is no movement into Egypt and into Jordan of all those who used to live in Gaza, because this is what worries our Egyptian and Jordanian friends. And this would, of course, ruin all the resolutions of the Security Council that Gaza is Palestine, together with the West Bank.
Can I move on to some other topics, please? An international pariah, that is what some have called, in the face of sanctions, Russia. Now, last month, you had the Belt and Road Forum in China. President Putin was there. And it's clear that there were a lot of countries willing to do business, wanting to speak to Russia. That's what's come out of that. How is the world's biggest country isolated, as the West is saying, if that's the case? Is it ignorance, or is it just a lack of knowledge about the geopolitical reality in the rest of the world?
No, I think this is the goal which they loudly announced. Strategic defeat to Russia on the battlefield, isolate Russia, make it pariah or a rogue state. What is worse, pariah or a rogue state?
I'm not sure which.
Anyway, they were calling us, you know, all names. They were announcing, declaring all kind of goals to eliminate us as an influential player in the world arena. You mentioned Road and Belt Forum, where President Putin was main guest and spoke immediately after the host, the president of China. G20 summit, BRICS summit, many other events which Russia attended without any rights being curtailed. On the contrary, at the summit of G20 in New Delhi, a declaration was adopted by consensus which does not condemn Russia, which does not mention even Russia when it speaks about Ukraine and other conflicts in the world, which the West didn't want to notice. I mean, didn't want to mention. They wanted and still want to Ukrainize each and every agenda of each and every international forum. And this was never going to fly. And this is not flying already. The countries of the global majority of the global South don't want to allow the West to continue to decide each and every issue on this planet on its own, in its own interests.
Can I put to you as well, that was demonstrated at the Russia-Africa summit
this year in
St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
With that in view, many analysts said it's one of the main international events of the year. What impact has that had on Russia-African relations, and how do you see those relations, those ties moving forward? What's the focus for Russia?
This was a second Russia-Africa summit. Yeah. The first ever was hosted in October 2019 in Sochi, and then, you know, coronavirus interfered, and we could not convene the second one as we planned. But this year it became possible. 48 countries were represented out of 50. 27 of them at the highest level, presidents or prime minister. The attendance was very good, and the quality of the debate was very, very interesting. The debate indicated the awakening of Africa, though Africa awakened from colonialism long ago, but the most popular topic at the summit was that Africa does not want any longer to be a very rich continent which does not enjoy the richness it possesses. Like in the colonial times, most of the resources are being pumped raw into developed countries, and then processed and sold with huge profits. Actually, President Museveni of Uganda was giving an example of the world coffee market. The volume of that market, he estimated, which is, I think, confirmed by the World Coffee Organization, at some $460 billion worth, out of which Africa gets less than $30 billion. Selling beans, not even frying the beans, everything from the procession process is being done elsewhere. Germany alone gets the coffee industry of Germany gets more profits annually than all African countries. And this is what bothers them. They say we don't want just to be given some free trade regime to sell our raw material and natural resources. We want technology to be brought here. We want processing to be organized on the spot where you find the resources to process. And this was, I think, one of the key themes which was voiced during St. Petersburg Summit. We agreed a declaration which was a very strong political message that we want the key principles of the international law to be respected, especially the principles of the United Nations Charter. There is one which the U.S. and other Western countries never mention, namely the principle which says the United Nations is based on the sovereign equality of states. Never ever when the Americans and Europeans invoke for one or another purpose to justify some of the action or inaction by a UN Charter principle, they invoke various, in one case territorial integrity, in another case right of people to self-determination, but they never ever mention the principle of sovereign equality of states. And the Africans understand this, and they feel this. We also adopted plan of action for the next 3 years. We adopted several sectoral statements, including against bringing weapons to outer space, on information security, some others. We created, it has been created after the first summit, the Russia-Africa Forum, which acts like a secretariat for the future. And the leaders agreed that between the summits, between the second and the third summit, there should be Russia-Africa ministerial meetings, taking stock of what was done, what is necessary to do, to implement the goals put by the presidents and prime ministers.
Just two final points, if I may. Are you confident that we're living, or we will be living in a safe planet going forward? There seems to be so many conflicts breaking out. We had the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict seemingly resolved, but on so many other fronts, that's not the case. Are things resolvable going forward? Are we overstating the danger right now?
No, I think we don't. I think we do not overstate the danger, and I don't think we yet fully understand the risks of further developments in the direction of more and more conflicts. You mentioned Caucasus. The Americans and Europeans are trying also to drive a wedge between Russia and Central Asia. They would like to keep this chaos in the expectation that it would be manageable in the Middle East.
That's an area where they've had no real interest in for a long time. It appears to be speeding up there, the Americans wanting to get a focus, a grasp on Central Asia.
Well, yes, exactly. The Eurasian continent, especially the Asian part of Eurasian continent, becomes a powerhouse of the world economy. The integration structures existing in Eurasia, they established close links between themselves, Eurasian Economic Union with Shanghai Organization. Eurasian Economic Union and Shanghai Cooperation Organization with ASEAN. Eurasian Economic Union signed an intergovernmental agreement with China on harmonizing the Eurasian Economic Union plans with the Road and Belt Project. A few years ago, long before the current crisis, President Putin suggested that this natural cooperation, natural cooperative processes should be encouraged without setting some artificial deadlines or artificial goals. Let them, by working together, by talking to each other, understand where they have comparative advantage and what kind of voluntary division of labor profitable to everybody could be arranged. Mm-hmm. He said, let's call it Greater Eurasian Partnership. And he emphasized, which we continue to stress until now, that this partnership must be open to all countries and all organizations situated on the Eurasian continent, leaving the door open to those who believe that they are masters of the universe. But when they become sober, maybe they would understand the benefit of equality, mutual respect, mutually beneficial cooperation. If this takes place, then we will see what they will be able to tell us.
That just leads me to my final point in a roundabout way. Joe Biden recently said that it's Washington's mission to build a new world order for, quote, humanity. How do you interpret that?
Superiority complex and lack of analysis of the situation. The West was calling the shots in the world for more than 500 years, more than five centuries. And this era is over. It will take time. For this era to be replaced by multipolarity, which already started to take shape, because new centers of economic growth, of financial might, of political influence, military might. New centers appeared. China, India, Iran, Gulf countries, Latin American integration groupings, including CELAC. And they all want to have a better role. President Lula of Brazil suggested that CELAC should really think of getting rid of total dependence on the dollar and think about their own currency. He suggested the same in BRICS. Not the BRICS currency, but to think about alternative payment platforms. Because the way the Americans are abusing the role of the dollar with these unilateral sanctions, canceling overnight all the principles on which they were basing their model of globalization and inviting everybody to join. Assumption of innocence, safety of the property, inviolability of private property and of property in general, free trade. See what they have been doing to WTO. As soon as China started having an upper hand in world trade and world investments, and China was winning over the United States on the American-made turf, immediately WTO dispute resolution organ was immobilized. And it is still immobilized. So the Americans invent the rules, which they insist everybody must follow, as long as these rules serve the American interests. As soon as others become a bit more efficient than the USA itself, the rules are being changed. So I think President Biden had this in mind. Because the era, post-Cold War era, which seemed to be end of history, but did not prove that this is going to be the case, this era is coming to an end because of these new world centers of economic, military, political power and influence. And the process of shaping the new world order, it will take time. It might be a historic era, a whole historic era. The main thing, people say, well, the United Nations must be forgotten, it does not deliver. The reform of the United Nations is a must. Mm. If only because multipolarity brought to the key positions many new players who are not now represented in the Security Council as permanent members. And there are candidates whom we support as a very, very strong candidates like India and Brazil, for example, and Africa also, at the same time as Indian and Brazilian candidates are considered, African interests must be considered in the package. The problem of the Security Council is overrepresentation of the West. Mm. 6 out of 15 countries of the West, mostly NATO and other allies of the United States. So there could be no talk about adding new seats, new permanent seats for the Western countries, but the African, Asian, and Latin American countries must be in. But my last point is that what Joe Biden meant when he said that they would be working on a new order for the entire humanity was again the admission that their expectations that now everybody goes Fukuyama way and the liberal world order is dominating and everybody is saying yes sir, these dreams did not come true. So now they need to develop something new, but aiming at the same goal,
right?
Something new which they would call the shots for. Our position is that as for the legal basis, we don't need anything except the United Nations Charter. Sovereign equality of states, non-interference in domestic matters, respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity, but at the same time respect for right to self-determination. And by the way, the contradiction between the territorial integrity and self-determination was discussed in the General Assembly for many, many years. And in 1970, a declaration was adopted on the principles of the Charter as the basis for the relations between the states, And since then, nobody questioned that declaration. And on this particular seeming contradiction, the declaration stated everybody must respect territorial integrity of states whose governments respect principle of self-determination of people and by this represent the entire population living on a given territory. In other words, I don't think anybody could argue that after the coup in 2014, the neo-Nazist who came to power and whose first pronouncement was the elimination of the status of the Russian language in Ukraine. I don't think these people represented Crimeans and the east of Ukraine, where Russian language was the language of day-to-day life, of education, art, media, and so on and so forth. So all the principles are there. Mm-hmm. The main thing is that we have to make sure that they are applied in real life. And with multipolar system, which is objectively shaping, with more players, the system would be more sustainable. And with more players, it would be, I think, easier to deliver the principles of the UN Charter into real life, easier and more efficiently than just relying on the people who usurp the right to interpret the Charter and to impose their own rules on others.
Foreign Minister, thank you for your candor, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.